My name's Bill Giddings. My title today is An Energy Policy for the United States. And that is a question mark at the end because, as I hope to show you, I don't see that we have an energy policy, nor do I see any signs that either the executive branch or the Congress are about to develop one. I'd like to start by reading a letter to the editor of Chemical and Engineering News last December. This is a true story. In the late 18th century was born a new country, one destined for greatness. As the years passed, it blossomed into the most powerful country in the world, economically, politically, and militarily. There were many reasons it was able to grow to such strength. For one thing, it was blessed with an abundance of natural resources and raw materials to feed its burgeoning industries. For another, the Constitution and the government sworn to uphold it promised long-term political stability. But most important was the character of its people. They were strong, both morally and physically. They were resourceful, independent, freedom-loving people who believed and demonstrated that the only way to make dreams come true is through dedication, hard work, and a good education. Then about 100 years ago, something subtle began happening, something that would eventually threaten the very existence of this great and wonderful country. A chemical substance slowly found its way into widespread use by the people in this country. The suppliers of this wonder substance promised it would ease the pain and suffering of all mankind. It would deliver the people from their daily drudgery and make life easy and pleasurable. The people of the country were seduced into believing them. New industries developed to import increasing quantities of this substance and to distribute it far and wide. People's thirst for the new substance grew at an alarming rate. Prices escalated and profits soared to the point that billions of dollars eventually found their way back to the faraway countries where this substance was most readily harvested. People in these countries became rich beyond their wildest imagination. They raised their own powerful armies, then blackmailed, threatened, and destroyed neighboring governments who didn't approve of their appetite for power and riches. But back in the once strong country, things were taking a different course. The people had become irreversibly addicted to the substance. Every aspect of their lives revolved around it. It seemed to make life more bearable, but in fact it tended to make the people lazy, overweight, sloppy, and uncaring about their beautiful environment. Yet they couldn't wean themselves from this terrible addiction. The final chapter of this story is yet to be written. But there will not be a happy ending unless the people of this once strong and proud country wake up and take notice. They must overcome their seemingly unquenchable lust for this insidious substance. And what is this substance? Oil. In 1972, the Tahoma Audubon Society asked me to present a program for their membership on the subject of energy. And I was glad to agree because I was interested in learning more about it, and talking about it was the best way to learn about it. So as I read what I could find, I began to realize that our addiction to oil, especially for our automobiles, was the dominant factor in global economics and politics, and making us dangerously vulnerable. But before I could present my prediction of disaster, it had come true. OPEC, those who had the oil easiest to obtain, had decided that they were the ones to determine whether or not to sell it, and to whom, and at what price. World energy consumption, whether measured per person or as total energy consumption, has gone down since 1972 because of that OPEC decision. And suddenly there was interest in a national energy policy for the United States. Previous to that, the policy could have been put in one word, more. But President Nixon's Project Independence was to free us from dependence on imported energy, chiefly oil, within a few years. Imports of oil were reduced nearly by half from 1977 to 1982 because of high prices and Going along with that, increased efficiency, it became worth figuring out how to do better with less. But energy imports have gone up again as prices went down. And I've sketched here on the board the net oil imports to the United States. This is 1972. And then things went down and up again, and this was the next price hike, and things came down. But there has been, in the last 5 years, a 60% increase in oil imported. The Union of Concerned Scientists points out that it was not purely coincidence that Kuwait was invaded, just as imports of foreign oil approached half of U.S. consumption for the first time ever. Well, in 1979, President Carter called energy policy the moral equivalent of war. President Reagan, starting when he came into office in 1981, systematically dismantled the federal programs that had been set up to promote energy efficiency and use of renewable sources. Initially, he appointed a dentist, James Edwards, to be Secretary of Energy, I suppose to promote more drilling. And then he sought to abolish the Department of Energy entirely, but Congress wouldn't allow that. And as a symbol, they tore down the solar collectors that had been put up on top of the White House as a symbol. Federal tax credits for energy conservation and renewable energy sources were allowed to expire. Federal budgets for key areas of energy research and development were cut by 80%. The $194 million being spent on all energy efficiency research and development in 1990 is equivalent to less than 3 days worth of spending on Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. Nearly 70% of the Department of Energy's budget now goes to nuclear weapons production and cleanup. The remaining federal energy budget continues to be dominated by spending on fossil fuels and nuclear technologies. So, I would like to suggest, if I dare say it, that President Bush may have brought us war as the immoral equivalent of an energy policy. But that would be a better topic for Christy and Whit. Unfortunately, they're leaving today. I'm better prepared to explore with you what an energy policy might look like if we had one. There was a special issue of Scientific American published in September of 89 called Managing Planet Earth. It's available in the reference library if you want to look into it further. And there's an article in it on strategies for energy use, which brings in some of the subjects I've been talking about earlier this week on global warming and acid rain, which are bound up with our energy production and use. Worldwide energy demand increases even as knowledge of how energy use threatens the global environment grows. Coal and oil combustion produces acid rain, which damages lakes, forests, structures, and crops in Europe and North America. Nuclear fission produces long-lived radioactive wastes. Automobiles fill the air with smog, which threatens health and property throughout the industrialized world. Energy consumption dumps more than 5 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere each year. The resulting accumulation of carbon dioxide, coupled with other greenhouse gases, could warm the globe several degrees by the middle of the next century. Altering the Earth's climate at a rate from 10 to 100 times faster than the rate of climatic change at the end of the last ice age. We seem to be playing out an ancient myth. Prometheus stole fire and wound up chained to a rock, lashed by the seas and burned by the sun. We have captured the power of fossil fuels, and our penalty is the loss of personal and environmental health. The Bush administration has unveiled what they call a national energy strategy, and Energy Secretary James D. Watkins, in introducing it in February, said, quote, "We can neither solely produce nor conserve our way to a secure, environmentally sound, and affordable energy future. The National Energy Strategy will protect the pocketbooks of U.S. consumers, the jobs of U.S. workers, and the global environment. It will bring energy and environmental objectives into harmony. We believe incentives rather than governmental control is the answer. There are no harsh command and control measures or restrictions on business and industry that will reduce our standard of living. We think we have a powerful strategy for conservation, weaning from our voracious appetite for oil without hurting the American people. But we have a long way to go before this energy strategy is realistic." Well, what were the elements in that national energy strategy? Number one, raise domestic oil production by 3.8 million barrels a day by the year 2010. Domestic oil production has been declining since about 1970, even including what has come in from Alaska. Second, boost by the same year, 2010, and somebody pointed out that although 2010 sounds as if it's some ways the other side of a great divide, the turn of the century, it's as far from us as 1970. Boost by the same year electricity from solar, hydropower, biomass, and geothermal sources by more than threefold over today's level. I've given some indication here of what today's level is. All of those together fit into this small wedge in the total energy consumption pie. I am always astounded by how similar this 1990 depiction of our energy resources resembles the one in 1972, before any of this was called so abruptly to our attention. Oil is still nearly half, somewhere between 40% and 50%, all of that time. One difference is that coal is a little more and natural gas a little less than it was 20 years ago, but still those fossil fuels, those contributors to the greenhouse effect, are overwhelmingly what we're relying upon. Nuclear has expanded considerably in 20 years from 1% to 6, 7, 8%, depending on which set of figures you look at, but still it's very small compared to these others. In spite of price swings over a factor of about 5 at least, this just shows how the prices changed in the month of January of this year, which of course was in no way typical of history, but starting out at the opening of business of the new year at $26 to a barrel, then it dropped a little bit, then it was announced there would be no extension of the January 15th deadline for getting out of Kuwait, and things drifted up a bit. And when that deadline passed, jumped up to $32 a barrel, then the attack took place by the forces of the United Nations, and the price of oil dropped in 2 days down to just over half of what it had been 2 days before, which goes to show how market forces are not involved in determining the price of oil. Well, these are market forces, but they're driven not by supply and demand, but by geopolitical considerations and guesses as to what's going to happen. Well, the going on with the points, besides boosting this small wedge to three times its value, reduce oil imports from, it says here, 65% of domestic demand down to 40%. We've been down to 40% within the last 10 years once already. Speed production of nuclear power stations and end regulatory bottlenecks that prevent exploitation of natural gas sources. Open the Arctic Wildlife Refuge to vast exploration and drilling, which can only be done if Congress explicitly passes a law to do that. Employ various measures to improve transportation efficiency, enable utilities to profit from energy efficiency practices, make more money selling conservation than selling power from new power plants, because it's cheaper to do. Reduce energy demand in residential and commercial buildings, raise energy efficiency in industry, but lacking was any program on reducing carbon dioxide emissions from fossil fuel combustion. Lacking is any program to improve, because of governmental action, the energy efficiency of automobiles. Lacking is any program to try to reduce dependence on imported oil by putting extra taxes on it, as the governments of European countries have done for years and years. So the Union of Concerned Scientists executive director responded, "It's a national energy tragedy designed by the oil and nuclear industries and their allies in the White House. Modest increases in federal fuel economy standards for automobiles, phased in increases in fuel or energy taxes and tax incentives for increased electricity production from renewable sources are just a few of the measures stripped from the package by supply-side ideologues within the administration." And he's referring there specifically to John Sununu, White House Chief of Staff, to Michael Boskin, the Chair of the Council of Economic Advisers, and to Richard Darman, the Budget Director. So the policy which Admiral Watkins, Secretary Watkins, was introducing with pride was not the policy which he had prepared after public hearings and submitted to the White House. Well, there have been a number of bills introduced into Congress to require greater fuel efficiency in automobiles. This year, Senator Richard Bryan from Nevada and Senator Slade Gorton from Washington jointly introduced a bill to require increasing from the present 27.5 miles per gallon average for cars produced and sold in the United States up to 34 miles per gallon in 5 years and 44 miles per gallon in 10 years. Some have pointed out that the decrease in mileage standards that was allowed in 1986 from 27.5 had been achieved at that time down to 26 to make things easier for the automobile companies, cost more imported oil each year than the Arctic Wildlife Refuge can be expected to apply if it is fully developed. Transportation Secretary Samuel Skinner said in response to this proposal to raise the requirements that it could literally destroy the automobile industry in this country. Well, former Transportation Secretary Joan Claybrook, who is now president of the organization called Public Citizen, says that an auto fleet average of 35 miles per gallon, which would be 6 years down the road according to this legislation, would eliminate the need for oil imports entirely. So there are many different points of view about energy policy, what it can do and what it should do. But before discussing specific elements of this proposal, I'd like to do two other things. First, present the outline of an alternative energy proposal prepared by the Union of Concerned Scientists. And I've chosen that one to present because As a scientist, I am impressed by the fact that this one is signed by over 700 members of the National Academy of Sciences, by 67 National Science Medalists, and by 55 Nobel Prize winners. And those Nobel Prize winners include economics as well as natural sciences. And it is an appeal by American scientists to prevent global warming. They say, global warming has emerged as the most serious environmental threat of the 21st century. There is broad agreement within the scientific community that amplification of the Earth's natural greenhouse effect by the buildup of various gases introduced by human activity has the potential to produce dramatic changes in climate. Can't be confidently predicted, but could result in severe disruption of natural and economic systems throughout the world. More research is necessary. The United States bears a special responsibility to provide leadership in the prevention of global warming. It's the world's largest producer of the greenhouse gases that may bring this about and needs to set an important example for other nations. So the United States should develop and implement a new national energy policy based on the need to substantially reduce the emission of carbon dioxide while sustaining economic growth. The cornerstones of this policy should be energy efficiency and the expansion of clean energy sources. The policy should include a steady increase in motor vehicle economy standards while the search continues for fuels and other technologies that mitigate the carbon dioxide impact. 2, a substantial increase in federal funding for research on energy efficient technologies, as well as federal activities to enhance the adoption of more efficient energy use. I'll add in passing that the amount that our government is spending on research on energy efficiency was something like less than 3 days of Desert Storm. Third, development, demonstration, and commercialization of renewable energy technologies on a massive scale. 4, a nuclear energy program that emphasizes protection of public health and safety, resolution of the problem of radioactive waste disposal, and stringent safeguards against the proliferation of nuclear material and technology that can be applied to weapons construction. And 5, full consideration of environmental, social, and economic impacts in the establishment of federal subsidies and regulatory standards for development of energy sources. So that's another point of view, but before discussing that one or comparing them or our own ideas, I would like to present a different kind of an approach. A paragraph first, though, from the editor of Science Magazine. Clichés about world peace roll readily off the tongue, but there is perhaps no more dramatic form of aggression of developed countries against developing ones than a gradual global warming. Developed countries are largely in temperate zones and can survive increases in temperature. Many developing nations lie in the tropics, and greenhouse climate changes could make life marginal and desperate. Fortunately, this is not a case of them against us, for we are all in this environment together. The problem is one that will require politicians to think beyond the next election and citizens to think beyond the next generation. But the approach to that kind of question I want to share with you now is by Bill McKibben from his book called The End of Nature, which was first published in the September 11th, 1989 issue of The New Yorker and is now available under separate cover.
Well, that's a paper clip.
Yeah.
I went for the laundry.
He is saying, after all of this, or just possibly, we could change our habits. One very small example of an idea so large as to be unwieldy. To cope with the greenhouse world, people in the developed countries will probably begin to install much more energy-efficient washing machines. That would reduce somewhat the amount of carbon dioxide each of us puffs into the atmosphere. But what if, instead, people got together with their neighbors and agreed to buy a single washing machine for the entire block? Not such a novel concept to people in big city apartment houses. And what if they also decided that instead of continually buying fashionable clothes, they would reduce their wardrobes to a comfortable or even uncomfortable minimum? What if, in other words, we began to reject a pervasive individual consumerism and began to alter a basic way we look at ourselves? Mightn't such a path, broadened to include other facets of daily life, offer the best way not only to avoid overheating the planet, but also to keep from transforming it in the other sad ways he discussed earlier? And I have no plans to live in a cave or even in an unheated cabin. If it took 12,000 years to get where we are, it will take a few generations to climb back down. But this could be the epoch in which people decide at least to go no farther along the path we have been following. When we make not only the necessary technological adjustments to preserve the world from overheating, but also the necessary mental adjustments to ensure that we will never again put our good ahead of everything else's. This is the path I choose, for it offers at least a shred of hope for a living, eternal, meaningful world. As birds have flight, our special gift is reason. Part of that reason drives the intelligence that allows us to master DNA or build big power plants. But our reason could also keep us from following blindly the biological imperatives toward endless growth in numbers and territory. Our reason allows us to conceive of our species as a species, and to recognize the danger that our growth poses to it, and to feel something for which the other, and to feel something for the other species we threaten. Should we so choose, we could exercise our reason to do what no other animal can do. We could limit ourselves voluntarily, choosing to remain God's creatures instead of making ourselves gods. What a towering achievement that would be. Be so much more impressive than the largest dam. Beavers can build dams. Because so much harder. Such restraint, not genetic engineering or planetary management, is the real challenge. If we now, today, begin to limit our numbers and our desires and our ambitions, perhaps nature could someday resume its independent working. Perhaps the temperature could someday adjust itself down to its own setting, and the rainfall of its own accord. Well, if you think that's too much to expect, consider these comments from a review of another book entitled In Search of Environmental Excellence, Moving Beyond Blame. The reviewer says, those authors may be overly optimistic in their estimation of industry's willingness to abandon existing production facilities. They seem unable to recognize that the types of changes they suggest require nothing less than revoking the unwritten rule of capitalism that grants factories and living creatures equal access to air and water. It is hard to imagine the Fortune 500 abandoning hundreds of billions of dollars in capital investments. But history is filled with just these sorts of surprises. Twice before, Americans have agreed to landmark changes in the ground rules for capitalistic enterprises. On both occasions, agricultural and business interests fought bitterly to maintain what they considered their inalienable property use rights. On both occasions, their lobbyists buttonholed members of Congress to present persuasive economic and legal arguments in defense of the status quo. On both occasions, the tide of social change swept the old order aside as it did Ptolemy's universe. Today, there can be little doubt we are better for having abolished slavery and child labor. So what do you think? Can we do it? Or what shall we do?
Do you see any hope in any of the alternative fuels for automobiles alcohol, electricity, or natural gas.
Okay. Alcohol, there are two things that fit under that category, methanol and ethanol. When we talk about alcohol as a single thing rather than a category, then it's ethanol we're talking about. That's what can be fermented from grain. And Brazil has had a large program for fueling their vehicles, some entirely, others with a majority of alcohol, ethanol as the fuel. They got into that business because the world sugar market was so poor that they had all these sugar plantations going broke, and they could make alcohol from the sugar. Well, it has been shown that you can make vehicles easily that will work quite well on that fuel. But they've had some severe problems with it. The sugar market has picked up, and the plantations are selling some abroad, and so they actually recently imported 100 million gallons of alcohol from the United States for their... So that kind of a model probably wouldn't be suitable. I do have a long article exploring the use, though not of crops that otherwise could be used for food, but for agricultural wastes and things that neither people nor even animals can consume very well, but they think it would be at least 10 years of intensive development before something workable on a large enough scale to make that big a difference could result. Of course, in the Middle West, there are places where you buy gasoline that's 10% alcohol made from corn, but again, that's a matter of dealing with the crop surplus. It also improves the performance and cuts down on the air pollution. There's some advantages to it.
It's also more expensive.
Yeah. But the expense depends on a lot of things, including, I mean, the fact that it's done at all depends on its being, that part of it at least, being exempt from the taxes that are put on regular gasoline. And you're quite right, it's more expensive, unless you count, of course, the costs of petroleum. If the costs of the operations in the Middle East were included as direct costs of gasoline in the United States, we'd be paying $5.50 a gallon. And that's saying nothing about the environmental costs, the acid rain, the global warming, and the air pollution, so that in the Los Angeles area, they've decided that it's going to be illegal to use starter fluid on your backyard barbecues, because even that amount of contribution of hydrocarbon fuels to the atmosphere makes a difference in the intractable problem they have there. So you're right, it costs more at the pump, but it all depends on how you calculate the cost.
In Seattle, they're using methane quite a bit now. We have a number of methane-powered buses, and also we had a huge garbage dump that was just so bad and smelly between Seattle and Tacoma.
Mm-hmm.
And you could smell those fumes, that methane gas fumes on the way to Tacoma. They piped all, they're piping all of that methane gas now that comes up out of those fields, and they're using it.
I'd like to add to what you say there. First, as far as that landfill is concerned, the impetus for putting in those pipes and collecting it was that across the freeway, it had built up in people's basements to the point the fire department made them evacuate. And we'll say a little more about that aspect of things next week when I talk about solid waste and landfills. But you're right, there is a source which, if properly designed from the beginning, could make a significant contribution. And part of the trouble we got ourselves into is the overwhelming dependence on one source. If instead of expecting to replace half or more than three quarters of your energy consumption from fossil fuels with the answer, if you have 20 different things, each of which is 5%, then you've got 100%, and if one of those goes bad, you've only lost 5%. Now, the buses in Seattle, I believe, the ones with the signs on them at least, were fueled not with methane, but with methanol. And that's the other kind of alcohol. That can be made not by fermenting vegetable material. It can be made from coal. It can be made from natural gas. In both cases, what you're doing in this process, in order to make from a solid or a gas, which aren't as convenient to handle, to make a liquid fuel, is you're partly burning it to make methanol out of it. And so you can't get near as much energy per gallon as you can from the gasoline. And the same is true of the ethanol, only half as much so.
But is the processing and all that stuff cleaner?
Well, as far as the coal is concerned, it's not, you aren't getting the dirty part of the coal in your tank and out your tailpipe. It is somewhere else.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
And as far as the contribution to the greenhouse effect, that is worse because you're getting less energy efficiency out of your coal because you're partly burning it first without getting any benefit from that to make the methanol. And Seattle has now abandoned that experiment. They found that the maintenance costs on those buses were just out of sight. Unlike the ethanol, the methanol is corrosive to the kinds of metals that are used, so everything from the gas tank to the carburetor to the fuel lines has to be made out of something different. And as far as the air pollution implications, they're different, shall we say. Some are less, but some may be worse with those fuels. Now, as far as natural gas, methane is concerned, it's Pierce Transit, Tacoma and Pierce County, that has begun to buy, has received some, and by next year will have 50 buses, third of their fleet at that time, that will be powered by natural gas. But of course you've got to have a great big tank, or else a very strong tank, so it can be put in under high pressure. But that's nothing new. We saw natural gas powered buses in Shanghai and China, where they have the natural gas, and the engines don't have to be much different. In fact, those same buses are made so they can switch to gasoline or diesel if they need to. I don't know how they can do that, but I think that's what the article said, because gasoline and diesel are so different. But natural gas and gasoline, you can switch back and forth. And for private cars, some have experimented with vehicles where you run them with the methane in the city because the air pollution is so very much less from that. But you can't go as far on a tank full because this is a gas, not a liquid. It's not nearly as concentrated. And so you can switch over to gasoline if you're out on the road on long trips. You can't fill up conveniently. Yes, Mark?
The desire to find another fuel for our cars seems to run into all kinds of problems. Even if you went to something distilled from vegetable matter, then you're using the soil as a source.
That's right.
Soil erosion.
Strip mining the soil.
Right, exactly. So it seems like we need to have some kind of lifestyle change and emphasis more on walking and biking. Mass transit. Do you see any hope in maintaining our lifestyle based on a car?
Well, I don't see any hope on that, regardless of the energy situation. If again we take Seattle area as an example, they're now adding high occupancy vehicle lanes to the interstate between Seattle and Tacoma to try to funnel more people through there, because it can take, instead of 50 minutes, it can take over 2 hours to go between the two at rush hour. So this great freedom and mobility that we are wedded to for our car is the freedom to sit for an hour in a traffic jam, mm-hmm. breathing the fumes. And it's primarily the automobile that's made the atmosphere in Los Angeles, sometimes, from my point of view, essentially unlivable. So I think we're going to be driven to doing something different.
Are there light rail plans or something for Tacoma?
Well, what there are talking about it, but you're talking about billions of dollars and where is it going to come from in the near future and so forth. They have put some express buses on. Actually, it's Pierce Transit from Tacoma that's put in these express buses, several in the morning, several in the afternoon, to Seattle, because a lot of people from Tacoma work in Seattle. And they found that the demand was so high, they want to expand that service considerably. But in order to afford to do that, they're going to have to take some buses off some other lines that run virtually empty. I spent a sabbatical in Seattle a couple of years ago. That's 45 miles, essentially, from where I live. But there was no way I was going to spend 2 to 3 to 4 hours a day in a traffic jam on the freeway. So we ran away from home, rented an apartment, and bought a bus pass. And still had to have a car there, though, because I wanted to go visit my mother halfway in between without spending all day doing it. But it takes a certain concentration of people, which seems to be happening whether we like it or not, in order to make mass transit really workable. It also takes subsidy, but of course the highways themselves are a tremendous subsidy to the automobile, to say nothing of the subsidy to petroleum, of the military protection of our resources there. So it's where we socially choose to put our money.
Well, they're talking about using the unused railroad tracks all the way from above Everett, mm-hmm. through Marysville, to Seattle, down to Olympia. Those are the railroad tracks from Great Northern that are no longer used. So
yeah, and that's
they
fine.
Have the tracks already laid.
Provided that where you want to go is from where the tracks are to where they go.
This is a political question, but what was the real cause for doing away with most passenger train service in the United States?
It didn't make money.
Wasn't as fast.
Compared to freight, it was a loser.
Some people blame the unions too.
Well, that's one of the reasons it didn't make money, was the costs of the labor as well. And, of course, another reason was that people got their cars and preferred to use them, and jet aircraft came in and cut down so much on the amount of time it took to go any great distance. Although now, I'm sure that between Seattle and Portland, for example, that if you're starting downtown and want to end up downtown, you can do it quicker on the train if you're going the time the train goes. Then you can get to the airport, go through the process there, fly
20 minutes in the air
to the airport from which you've got to then get downtown.
The distances are so different, but in Europe there's such a great rail system compared to ours.
Right, and it's distance and concentration of people and public attitudes, of course.
Well, isn't it really true that the fact that they ran out of their resources so long ago, and we still have a country that has resources, and they've been depleted for so many years?
And it's also true that the price of gasoline is purposely several times as high as it is here, that there is $3 to $5 a gallon tax put on top of the price otherwise would be higher than here because we have produced maybe half of what we use and they don't.
It is a lot of public effort. I spent some time in Sweden and they have a great train and bus service, and it's not a very densely populated country. A lot of people live in the south, but it's not as densely populated as some regions of the United States. So it is, mm-hmm. it is mostly public attitude. I had lots of friends in Sweden. It's very common to know people that don't have driver's licenses because you just don't need them.
I might be cynical, but I don't think consumer trends are really going to change en masse unless two things happen. One, it becomes cheaper to do so and do the conservation minded thing, do the right thing, so to speak, or removing the products from the consumer stream entirely, like we did with DDT. Mm-hmm. We didn't tell people to be careful with it or to price it higher, whatever. We just said, you're not going to make it any longer. And I'm feeling really cynical about this because I don't think large numbers of people are really changing their lifestyle at all. I think some people are, but it's really a small minority. In the city I live in, which is St. Paul, we have voluntary recycling and it's picked up at our curbside once every 2 weeks. There are three of us on my block that have been doing that now for years, but no one else does it. They don't. And that's despite flyers and leaflets and people going door to door, and they just don't do it. It's not a priority. So I feel very cynical. The government's not doing anything. And we'll probably have Bush in the White House for another 4 years after this year. And I don't see large groups of people changing their consumer habits or even their recycling habits.
Well, Seattle's doing a great job.
Yeah, see, yeah.
Seattle is, we've got
maybe
recycling.
Maybe we'll be able to shame them into doing something. And also, it may be that in certain places you wake up and die right, because boy, I'm telling you, they're closing dumps all over this country like greased lightning. And we've got like 2 years left on ours in Pierce County, and then what are we going to do? And they want to put in a $90 million incinerator on us, and we don't want that. And you know, and so we had 300 people show up at one of our public hearings, and we told our legislators, yeah, you're going to do recycling, you're going to do all kinds of stuff you didn't know you were going to do, and we just put the heat on them, and they're doing it now. The government's responding to us.
If you don't do recycling in Seattle, you pay more for your garbage.
That's
a
good.
A whole lot more.
Yeah. That's the way it ought to be.
As far as what has happened in energy efficiency, and as I say, it was driven first by price increases, which made it important and worthwhile to do things that people weren't doing before. But from 1978 to 1988, the United States has cut by 22% the amount of energy that's used to generate a dollar's worth of, quote, real GNP, unquote, whatever all that includes. And so that in that regard, as far as energy efficiency, according to that article, at least, we have caught up with Germany, but we still use 50% more energy in our GNP production than Japan does. Because of laws passed by Congress, the average miles per gallon of automobiles of the model year has doubled from 1974, when it was 14.2. to 28.3 in 1989, but again, only because of congressional action. And back in the 70s, there was considerable interest on the part of the public, which was transmitted to their representatives. Of course, on the other hand, we now have 50% more vehicles on the road, and the amount of miles driven per person has increased significantly since then, too. And part of that last is that gasoline prices in constant dollar terms, adjusted for inflation, have been lower in the last few years than ever before in history. There are many more things that could be done. Industry has had a closer eye on the bottom line than most of the public have. But again, they, like Congress and the executive branch, look at things on a fairly short-term basis, and they're responsible to their stockholders on annual return on the dollar rather than primarily being held responsible to the generations to come. But the public in some cases is persuaded to pay a little more if the payback is going to be within a year or two. You'll get more than your money back with a more efficient appliance or light bulb or automobile or furnace. Enough people have done it to make some difference, but not nearly enough. And I think you're right that a national energy policy that is meaningful and helpful will be needed, whether we'll get it or not.
Besides what you're doing, do you see any role for the church in this picture?
Well, there has been a considerable effort here during the last couple of years when Al Pitcher was scholar in residence to develop in local churches task forces on care for the creation. And out on the table out there are handouts available. The title was On Earth as in Heaven, which was last year's theme for the village, on living toward God's future, responses to what the natural world is telling us, that have long lists, as there are many, many books available giving you 150 things that you can do, not to save the world per se, but to help a little bit along that direction. And
let me ask it a different way. What is the role of the church? Is the role of the church to educate its people? Is the role of the church to provide society with a conscience? What is the role in this particular thing?
I would say yes, yes, and to set an example, to be the light on the hilltop or whatever. And I would say that church people should have the most reason to take the problem seriously, because it is care for the creation. It is also care for our neighbor. Our neighbors now throughout the world, and our neighbors to come in the future generations. Rudy.
Yeah, I view this as really a grassroots problem and solution. You know, we have the kind of an energy policy we want today.
That's right.
That's exactly what we want. We don't want a policy that says we can't drive our automobiles, mm-hmm. you know, and we do not want to raise the price of gasoline to where it is level with the world market on gasoline. We should be paying $2.50 to $3 a gallon, or $4. Then we would have something to work with in order to make some changes, but we don't want that. And our people and government are strictly on a short-term election kind of basis. And if we told them to do something like we want them to do, maybe some of us, they simply wouldn't get reelected. That's and right. Somebody else would. So, you know, we deserve what we have. And it's a grassroots kind of thing. And it will only change when it hurts us individually to the point that we want something to happen. We got excited when we had to line up for gas at the gas station. We did something.
Yeah.
And it's only when the pressure is on that we as humans react.
Yes, Rex.
I don't know if any of you have ever thought about this, but we're putting in what they call high occupancy vehicle lanes. And the implication of that is the other lanes are for single occupancy vehicle lanes, which really is offensive to me.
Yeah.
In other words, if you're going to run the high occupancy lane, then you have to have two or three or whatever the sign says, or you have to ride a motorcycle, which gets about 60 miles to the gallon. And that means that our tax dollars are going to build an extra lane on a bridge, an extra lane on every freeway between Seattle and Everett, or Tacoma and Everett, and it's so offensive to me. And now when I see one person in a car, I feel like saying, you ought to have to pay three times that amount. Because, you know, I mean, why do the rest of us have to pay? Of course, they're paying too, but...
But some of those freeways are not adding a lane. They're taking a lane that before had three or four lanes to the single occupancy vehicle had the right to.
Well, that's what you ought to do.
And I think that's...
I think they ought to have three high occupancy lanes and one for the single...
But they actually are adding a lane where we live.
Another thing, too, that's happening, and I also live in Seattle, but is... where I work at the Children's Hospital, and in order for us to expand our building, the footprint of our building, the city government came back to us and said, there's certain things you need to do.
Right.
And included in that was to penalize those people that drive to work in terms of paying for parking more than the hospital would need to charge to pay for the parking lot in order to discourage the use of those arterials which are jammed by the university. And so there are some ways that is exerted to make things a little more uncomfortable, to make people think twice. You know, bus passes are subsidized.
Right.
People who can walk to work or can show that they have bicycled to work and not used a car can go down and collect a $10 bill at the end of the month. So there are some ways that things have happened that can change things at a grassroots level, really.
Right, and there's discussion at the University of Washington of actually giving free bus passes to all the students. I mean, they now get a 1/3 subsidy, but that hasn't made enough difference.
Yeah, well, I went to a land use planning class, sat in on it at the UW, and one of the things that they told a developer who wanted to put in a big thing at the university, he wanted to, as you say, enlarge the footprint of his building. He had to provide, and I don't know how they put it in, the people that work in that building, well, he's not going to be the person running that, but there has to be some system between the builder and the occupants of that building so that they will continue to get free bus passes. Because that was part of the deal for him to be allowed to build that building, which is cool. And years ago in Seattle, they wouldn't allow people to expand the size of the streets because they did not want to encourage people to drive their cars. When they built private homes in the smaller, in the communities, they said, this is a community and you're not going to have a three-car garage there, and we're not going to make the roads bigger for you to do that. And that was like 60, 70 years ago, long time ago.
There are a lot of local regulations, like we're talking about now, that have made
areas.
Differences in some local areas. Let's see, how do they say it? If you build it, they will come? You had your hand in? No, I thought you did.
Yeah, well, she was saying something about the rural area, and I think a lot about the rural area, mostly when you're in down in Olympia, for instance, in the state of Washington. I'm sure it's true other places, that the money that should go for a decent road with a decent size side of the road and decent ditching and so on and places for people to get off and all of that, the farm to market roads never get the money they should get to make them decent roads. And if we, you know, and I, like I was saying, you're paying for those HOV lanes too if you live out in the country and you're trying to produce. The agricultural people really pay through the nose for everything. I mean, they pay 9 times or 10 times what it costs, what their costs are to the society. They really overtaxed, overburdened. by comparison with what other people do in the cities. We don't pay our own way.
Except for water, that's not true, but otherwise.
Except for water, yeah. Well, especially in California for water, but even so, and of course they use pesticides too, which is a fuel consuming kind of thing. But I think in proportion, if you're talking about cars on the road, we did a study one time with our fifth grade class. When my child was in fifth grade class, I went to the teacher and I said, I want to know how many bicycles there are among the students in your class. And there was 1.5 bicycles for every student in that fifth grade class. And we thought that was really interesting because we were trying to make bicycle pathways and sides of the roads, you know, marking and fixing the grates so people wouldn't fall in them and break their neck on a bicycle. And we were trying this whole system in the city of Tacoma. And these kids, there are zillions of bicycles. But the kids can't ride them because there's no safe place to go. It's terrifying. And I asked my son, I said, where do you want to go? When you get on your bicycle, where do you want to go? And he said, when I'm on my bicycle, I'm where I want to go. And I thought, now there is that's a profound statement, because we were trying to say, well, we could make a trail, a bicycle thing that would go from the major population source to the stores, to the parks, along the edge of the creeks, things like that, you know, try to decide where they should be. But they really need to be the roads. I mean, we need to just close some roads and say these are bicycle roads and like they do in China. In China, you hop on your bicycle to go downtown, and you ride downtown to 500 other people that are going downtown on their bicycle.